He was an activist before he was an entertainer.
And before I ever learned how to dance a jig, I gave a damn about American politics. I gave a damn about the people of America, and I took to the streets and I advocated.
Only weeks ago, he spoke out in Atlanta after the tragic murder of George Floyd.
I'm mad as hell. I woke up wanting to see the world burn down yesterday because I'm tired of seeing black men die.
He is also a businessman and one half of the Grammy Award-winning group Run the Jewels. Michael Render, aka Killer Mike, an activist, a husband, a father, and a businessman. He owns a chain of barbershops with his wife, Shay, called Swag. Shave, wash, and groom. Also, you may remember watching Michael's extraordinary documentary called Trigger Warning.
Anything that doesn't help black people needs to be burned the fuck down now.
If you have not tuned into that, you should see it. It has twists and turns, and it will keep you on the edge of your seat. He joked and said that he went hungry and he did not have the opportunity to smoke weed for 3 days.
Oh, it is so wonderful to have you, Michael, join me today on Hello Somebody. Michael Render, the one and only from the West Side, right? Did I get that right?
Yep, I am from the West Side of Atlanta. People on the West Side always joke that my family's from Alabama, though, so that's even more West.
That is, but have they fully accepted?
Yeah, oh, we are. We West Side. Okay. Half of the West Side is from Alabama. So.
Half of the West. So you're talking about the Great Migration. Don't
yeah, absolutely.
Started on that, right? Well, everybody black, 90% of us, or maybe a little more, got some folks.
In the South, yeah, 54% of black population in this country live in the South, which should be a political stronghold. So we got about, we got some organizing to do down South.
Yeah, we got to work on that. And we know from history of slavery that over 90% of our people came from the South, obviously.
Yeah.
Why? And I don't know if I share with you, my dad's family is from Gainesville.
Yeah, you did.
Georgia. So I got a little street cred.
Yeah, you got to come down, guys. Yeah, hey, man, listen, man, I love Georgia. My grandfather was from Eatonton, Georgia. And my grandmother was, from Alabama. So that's like people tend to look at the South as one big place, but there's subtle differences. Like in Georgia, they put sugar in their grits and cornbread. In Alabama, they don't, so it's all kind of little. In Georgia, my grandfather ate yellow meat watermelon, in Alabama, just red meat for my grandmother. So
about no yellow meat. You might need to talk about that.
That's a delicacy. That is that's like eating one of those $1,000 steaks with gold flakes on it.
Come on, talk about it.
Shayna gets them. She don't even want to share them with the family. Just greedy.
Is that right?
Yeah. With me, but I can't say anybody else get it.
Nobody else?
Yeah.
Well, the queen doesn't have to share if she don't want to, huh?
Absolutely.
So, Michael, always known as Killer Mike, part of the dynamic duo Running the Jewels. I know that you're going to have a release. So June 5th, I think?
Yeah, we just announced Run the Jewels 4 will be released June 5th. It was supposed to be released back in April, and we were supposed to be doing 2 weeks of Coachella. But unfortunately, the pandemic has happened, and it's just best that people stay inside and just see what the health officials are saying. So we're going to be touring next year, opening for Rage Against the Machine. Hopefully, we'll be playing Coachella whenever they reannounce for that. And until then, the album hopefully will give you some solace during quarantine, and you can just rock out at the crib until we get back out on the road.
Come on now, talk about that. Talk about rocking out. So two things you just mentioned that I want to go a little deeper into. One is rocking out. You had a fantastic birthday party on 420.
Yeah.
We were rocking out virtually. It was a beautiful thing when dived in there a little bit.
Yeah, you popped up. I was honored to have
that. Was all Shay.
And I was totally embarrassed to be so stoned.
I was like, you.
At one point, I was singing to my wife, and Shaquille O'Neal was calling, and I was apparently I had gotten so into the libations in the moment. I said, "Man, fuck Shaq, I'm singing to you. And I'm singing if I was your girlfriend, my friend."
Yes.
Yeah, and I was out, and then I was just like, "Hold on, Shaq's the homie, and he is also Shaq. So get done with the song and call Shaq back." And I did. So he called me, Puff called, Kelly Rowland, who's friends with my wife, and just I love her to death. And a lot of people, including yourself, of prominence and much more important stuff to do, called to wish me a happy birthday, and I sincerely appreciate it.
Oh, it was a high honor, and a shout out to Shay, your wife.
Yeah.
And so when you talked about, when you talk about COVID, you mentioned that you have done public service announcements for DeKalb County, that is the second highest rate, I think, of COVID-related.
DeKalb County is a neighbor of Atlanta, right next to it. So their CEO, essentially their mayor, is Mike Thurman. And he's a friend of mine. He's someone I know and respect from politics in Georgia and in DeKalb, which would be a part of metropolitan Atlanta. He calls me. He says, "Hey, Mike, we're doing good with keeping older people, people who would be your parents' age and up, you know, 60 and up, in the house, and you know, the younger kids, because schools are out there saying." And he said, "But there's really this middle of the ground. And it's the kids who would be listening to rap music and essentially are influenced by people who are in the hip hop culture. They're not quite getting the message." The governor has opened the state back up, and they all congregated in this park. And just had a lot of fun. And you got to understand that, because people have been locked in. You want to see your friends, your loved ones. And the fun got so packed and so close that it looked like, you know, it looked like Freaknik. It just looked like it was just, this is just too good. So he said, I just need help getting the messaging out.
This is DeKalb County CEO Mike Thurman. "Please think twice before leaving home. Don't believe me? Well, maybe you'll listen to my brother, Killer Mike."
"What's up? It's Killer Mike. But the real killer is COVID-19, and it's still out here."
Apparently it's helping some, but I just want to thank, you know, Michael Thurman. You know, a lot of politicians refuse to engage people who are in entertainment, and that's, to me, that that trepidation oftentimes betrays your constituency, because young people vote and you ask them to be politically involved and to be socially engaged. But then the people who they most identify with, you don't engage when you need them. And he has engaged me when there weren't times of crisis, when they made alterations to the jail to make it more fit to have people come in, not have to stay in, get involved in programs like GED. He brought me in as one of the people to walk through the program. Michael has kept me engaged in a lot of things that are going on in DeKalb County, and particularly Southwest DeKalb, where there's a high rate of Black people. And I appreciate him for respectfully engaging me as a constituent and as someone who cares about it, and not just as an entertainer, but he also helps me use my platform to amplify the messages we need for good. And he's a great example of politicians working with the people in his community for the betterment of them all. So I just want to salute him for that, and I thank him.
That's beautiful. We need more activist mayors like that. And Michael, you are an entertainer plus. I mean, you are an activist. Yeah. You care about social justice. You have lived that. You navigate both beautifully. You are a bridge in that way. Why do you care so much? I mean, you could just only do the entertainment part of yourself. We all are multifaceted.
Yeah, my wife, she reminds me, your job is singing and dancing. Don't forget that. But my passion, you know, probably gotten from my grandparents. My grandfather was just fiercely about enjoying every liberty the Constitution promised him. You know, he was an old Black man. He fished, he hunted, you know, he grew food. He made money independently. You know, his thing was just, there's no better country, as bad as troublesome as it can be, for people who look like us. Yes. Due to systems that are not broken, that were long made before we're here, but they're going to be broken in our lifetime, I believe, and others after. He just believed that you should enjoy every liberty and that there was no better place to get your start. So I love and appreciate this country. And with that said, my grandmother was staunchly about civil rights and social rights. So she's had me engaged in political campaigns and just doing the right thing since a very young age. And at about 14, 15, I just became an activist myself. And there's actually an article from when I was 17 years old organizing with another group of kids. I'm going to throw up at one point, just because people a lot of times think you get rich and then you feel guilty. And then you just say, well, let me throw myself at any social activist thing. I'm sure some actors and entertainers come to it that way, but that's not how I came to it. I've been doing the work. You know, I've been doing the work at this point 30 years of my life. And, you know, I just because I got a good job and I enjoy singing and dancing does not absent me from the process of making sure that society works in a way that benefits, you know, my community and the greater community. And my legacy after singing and dancing and hopefully building successful businesses with my wife and doing cool things, I want my legacy to be one of always having been a compassionate capitalist, that always have been an entertainer and activist, and always been as someone who did what's right for himself as an individual, his community, and the greater community. I feel like that's my duty.
Hey, man, Michael, is there such thing as compassionate capitalism? You know, we're in a great debate in our society right now with all of the predatory type capitalism that's going on. I mean, the wealthiest men in this country, 8 of them all white, I must put out there, even if they were black, I would be saying the same thing. But why 33 million people and counting are unemployed and don't have health care?
Yeah,
these
absolutely.
Men are making money hand over fist. People like Jeff Bezos, et cetera. I mean, well, is there a such thing as compassionate capitalism?
Absolutely. What non-compassionate capitalism looks like is the politician from Georgia who dumped her stocks time she was briefed on what was going to happen with COVID and bought medical stocks. That's evil. You know, but that doesn't borderline evil. That's evil because it shows that your ultimate motivation is money. Compassionate capitalism is something that I've seen a lot of companies out of Georgia, believe it or not. Now, whether you agree with these companies' overall philosophy, I've seen companies like Chick-fil-A be better for my community in terms of the programs and around education and they funded. Capitalism like the Waffle House. I've seen the Waffle House in the midst of this pandemic when it's been hard for people to get the basic staples, whether it be meat or ketchup or mustard, not only have their stores where you can order in and out, but at their door now you can just go buy some of the things that you usually would have to go to a grocer. For a company to pivot that way shows that the leadership or the inception of that company is a way that's morally grounded in a way that some companies aren't. Now, for the swag shop, even though we have not been able to open as a barbershop because we don't want to expose our barbers or expose our customers potentially to COVID, what we've been able to do is take our space and help feed the homeless downtown. We've been able to go out remotely and help and just as a staff. And we've been able to make sure our barbers have the ability to do house calls in terms of connecting them with customers. But compassionate capitalism is something or an idea that my wife and I have that I'm not going to be in a community making money and taking that money and not putting anything back in that community. So we're constantly engaged with ground level 501c3s to see how we can take not only a portion of our profits, but draw other monies to them. Next Level Boys Academy, which is an academy down in Atlanta that helps get young men in particular off some, you know, young men facing 20, 30, 40 year sentences. They get an opportunity to enter this program and avoid that time of jail time. And to the point where we had an issue with the restaurant, we fixed that issue with the restaurant. We got that restaurant to donate $10,000 to that Boys Academy. And in addition to that, the young man came out of the kitchen of the restaurant who was working there and working his way up the chain. Hopefully the management says, I'm a product of this. I didn't even know y'all were coming today. But this program turned my life around. If I, as a capitalist, did not have the compassion that my grandmother instilled in me to understand that making money is simply not enough, you have to reciprocate to the community that funds you, I wouldn't have been in a position to do that. So I have to be in a position to make money, to provide goods and services that people want to buy in order to then use compassion to make sure that I'm funding things like we do haircuts for the homeless in partnership with Hope Through Soap, with people who help people who may be temporarily or permanently homeless to get them in transition and to look. A lot of times transforming the way people look. Kids who are going to school, my wife and I did shoes last year. We got Nike and those who buy Nike to donate over 100 pair. You know, so our thing is we always want to be engaged in the community, expressing compassion.
You're a philanthropist, too. If you had to describe yourself, I mean, you are an activist, a social justice warrior of sorts first and an entertainer second. I mean, I first met you on the battlefield, so to speak.
Yeah.
supporting a candidate that you and I both support. I mean, that's how we met. And it was politics that brought us together. And I'm ever grateful for that.
Absolutely, as am I, man. As if you do the, work, you do good work, you meet good people, and hopefully, you know, those relationships endure and go on. You know, my, you know, it's easy to support political candidates every 2 to 4 years. It's not as easy to find people who are truly special and meant to progress us as a community. And you are that. You are one of the main reasons I was with that campaign. You will be, you will forever be a part of the people who made me believe that that policy is possible. And I revere you as a fearless leader, much like Shirley Chisholm was, you know, before you. And she was actually an idol of my mentor and dear friend, rest in peace, Alice Johnson, who's a former former director of the Atlanta Fools Commission on Children and Youth, which was an organization co-created by Andrew Young's late wife, Jean Childs Young. So I'm 1 and 2 degrees away removed from the people who actually did the civil rights movement. So, you know, and I say that just to qualify to the audience, when I make a Shirley Chisholm comparison with Nina, it is an absolute factual, solid fact based on her work, not her words. There are a lot of eloquent speakers that are of the same race we are, or of the same ethnic background, and their eloquence, well, they can align themselves in any way. They could be Ida B. Wells one speech, they could be Sojourner Truth another speech. That is not the same as pushing policy and progressing the public in a way that Shirley or Ida or Sojourner did. And you do those things. Part of my staying with that campaign and staying with you after the campaign has been to make sure that you receive national voice, whether that's the Breakfast Club or CNN or wherever. We're there to support you because I believe, you know, I like to just sing and dance. I would rather not have to do some of the other stuff. So I want the people who are qualified to do it, you being one of those people, to be doing it so I can sing and dance and smoke recreational marijuana.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that, Michael. I mean, you have been such a champion for causes, great and small, and you've been one of my biggest champions for sure. I'm thinking back to a photograph we just took earlier this year. We were at a museum in North Carolina, and we were in front of the one and only Fannie Lou Hamer. And I wasn't even thinking about taking a photograph at that time.
Well, you had to do that.
You asked Jennifer, you said, get this.
You got to do that, man.
It was iconic. And I look at that photo often, and it reminds me to keep going and always be sick and tired, never relent. Sick and tired of being sick and tired. And we have so much work to do. So I just love you and Shay. And then I want to shout out Charlamagne, the guy.
Yeah, Charlamagne is my friend. Absolutely, wow. Man. Lenard, that's my man.
Lenard, yes.
Yeah, man, from Monk's Corner, South Carolina. Man, that brother is one of the most, I tell him all the time, he's a Dan Rather of our time. He gets called a radio host and personality, but that man is a journalist. He investigates, he discerns, and he helps give voice to people to tell the truth, not their truth. You know, we're in the age of my truth. No, the truth.
Yes.
He's about people coming on telling the truth.
And I
love and respect he. And there are a few people that are doing that work. Tamika Mallory, Teslin Figaro, T.I. Yes. has jumped in full, just both feet in. I'm like, hold on, you a superstar. He's like, no, sir. I'm a black man. We got to do this. And I
come on, you and T.I., Bankhead. You want to?
Yes,
you were quoted as saying when your story is written, when it is told, Bankhead will be a character, as I recall,
absolutely
in that story. You absolutely. And T.I. You've given food away to families
yes.
who are suffering
yes.
during COVID-19. Yes. We know that black yes. people are dying at 4 times the rate of our white
yes.
sisters and brothers.
Yes.
Black men especially are
yep.
dying at higher rates. But as a black community, we do this together. You know, I hate sometimes when we get into, is it a woman thing? Is it a man thing? I don't necessarily think the black community can afford to separate ourselves like that. Our liberation struggle has been together. There are
yep.
particular things that we need to talk about that may impact
yeah. Well, we can't afford to imitate other people's fights.
That's right.
Like,
that's
you know,
it.
Before we get back to the Bankhead thing, I just need people to know, I don't know how it works other places, but in the South, the black community is a matriarchal community.
Yes.
You know, if you ask your uncle or your dad or your granddad or your big dad, they're going to say, ask your grandma, ask your big mom, ask your mom. And decisions are made by consensus a lot of times.
That's
families
right.
get in a room. So I just want to say in all the mix of which men and which women and, you know, he versus she. I'm not saying that those disparities don't exist within our community. I'm saying they don't exist to the extent that we need to argue other people's fight for them. I have respected my mother and father equally and seen that more in my community than any other community. It is not a patriarchal community in the same way others are. There's much more shared power, even down to when we got our right to vote. Black Frederick Douglass said that women and black people, period, deserve the right to vote. They split allies by giving black men the right to vote, and right outside the church with black women with shotguns, making sure night riders didn't come. So we've been a team a long time. Let's not let other people's political agendas split our team. We need one another. Black men have often viewed black women as fearless leaders, so that ain't a lot of ground to make up. We already used to leadership by our mamas, our grandmothers, and community leaders, so that's not something we have to get accustomed to. You know, I just want to congratulate us for that, because we don't get that congratulations enough, you know, and black women especially, you guys are superheroes in our community. And it doesn't take just Mother's Day or International Women's Day for you to know that. Hopefully we letting you know in every mosque, temple, or church on Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays, because you deserve it. You know, you can't talk about the FOI in the Nation of Islam without the MGT. You know, if you don't talk about those disciplined sisters, you can't talk about those disciplined boys they raise. You know,
you can't
talk about a great male preacher, you know, if you ain't talked about the women of that church that's put in the work, whether it's ushering or making sure that people are organized. So there's no significant organization, no significant progress that has happened in our community without black women. You don't have the SCLC if you don't have the women of the SCLC. That's you don't right. have the NAACP if you don't have black
the
women.
The civil rights movement that, itself you, would not have
do,
moved.
Exactly. You do not have it. So when you talk about Fannie Lou Hamer, you're talking about a leader. And I want people to Google these names and go look at it, because, you know, she was a poor worker woman from Mississippi.
Sharecropper.
Yeah, that transformed not only her community, but the nation. You know, they tried to they say when she did her testimony, they threw up a White House briefing or something when she was talking.
Yeah, they did. President Johnson was so upset they couldn't stop her.
You can't stop a black woman. They tried to stop a sister.
And you know her courage, Michael, to even in the 60s to form coalition with our poor white sisters and brothers in Mississippi to say the freedom, the Mississippi Democratic Freedom Party, they defied the Democratic Party by forming an alliance based on what they had in common. And it was poverty. It was being poor. It was being stepped on, disregarded.
Absolutely. We have the same masters, man. We have the same masters. And when the poor and oppressed realize that's the day the world changes. We have the exact same masters. And they are great. I think I've got to get the quote. We got to find it. But Frederick Douglass says, something is of no sex. Something else is of no color. So he essentially was saying that the abolitionist movement and the womanist or feminist movement at the time both deserve equal rights under the U.S. Constitution at the same time. Well, the United States took 100 years to catch up to what he said in 1865, took them to 1965 to catch up. But what we don't understand is when that didn't happen at the same time, it fractured an alliance that was there. And we cannot continue to allow this stuff to happen. Fannie Lou Hamer was a visionary in partnering with poor white people, because she understood, even before some of them did, that we got the same masters. So if you was a poor, or what they would call a redneck or a cracker or a hillbilly in Mississippi, you didn't even understand that you were being paid significantly less than, say, a white person in Pennsylvania or Illinois, simply because of where you were and companies exploiting you. And the only solace you had was to say, well, I'm better than a nigger. And if that's all the solace it took, then that means you were duped, black people were duped, and everybody had been duped and stayed in this position. That woman broke out and she literally said, you know, if I fall or if I die, I'm going to die going forward. And
that's it. Come on, man.
That's just, it's just chill through my spine now. But my mentor, Alice, was a white woman from Northern Chicago, my friend. And she's the person that introduced me to so many of the great women. You know, whether it was Mrs. Cleaver, whether it was Fannie Lou Hamer, Shirley Chisholm, she's the one who let me, you know, women were involved, but she named and showed the characters. These are the ones that she started my journey to understanding how much of the civil rights movement and the human movement has been progress by us. So I appreciate my friend and remember her. She's gone, and I appreciate you for being here. And that's one reason I so fiercely will defend and back you and support you always.
Thank you, Michael. And you are so blessed just to have been raised in the South in that way, because the deep roots, you know, I think it was Minister Malcolm, who said you would know the tree. Well, no, I'm quoting scripture. Malcolm X, yeah. or James Baldwin did. But in scripture, you would know the tree by the fruit that it bears.
Absolutely.
That Frederick Douglass that you were talking about, you know,
what's the quote?
Frederick Douglass, you know, was talking to President Lincoln, trying to get women suffrage. He said,
absolutely.
Right is of no sex. Truth is of no
color.
Come on, man. God is the father of us all.
Come on,
we are all brethren. 1846.
So think about that. That's 120 years before the United States called up. And now what's amazing about that is, when you say, well, what does it matter? What did women's suffrage and abolition have to do with one another? When you look at the Reconstruction period, when you look at Black men getting the right to vote, Black people as a community moving up, Black women, you know, being ornery enough to, like people in Geechee Gullah Islands, defending that right to vote with gun. You know, Ida B. Wells said a Winchester deserved a place of high honor in every Black man.
Yes,
so
she did.
We're seeing all these issues still continue. But the thing was, the Daughters of the Confederacy was born not long after that. So the same women who were wanted women's suffrage, who wanted the ability to vote for land ownership, that type of stuff, were fighting right next to abolitionists. Next thing you know, Black men get a right to vote before you, and then they start to stoke the racism. Well, niggers are getting a right to vote, and you're a white woman. You don't even got the right to vote. You could own niggers 20 years ago. Then you get this separation, the Daughters of the Confederacy pop up. So the same people who were allied, I ain't saying you're friends, I'm not saying you're besties, I'm not saying that you guys are going to be together forever, but you had a common political goal. Because they fractured that and gave a section the right and not another section, that splinter happens, and now you have 100 years of chaos, Jim Crow laws, feminist Black movement code versus civil rights movement. And we all don't understand yet we have the same master. If we would have followed, if Lincoln would have followed Douglass's advice in 1846, this country would be 2 years ahead of where we are already.
That's right.
we have to start recognizing our past missteps so we don't do them again. When people heard me give a speech, and I talked about, if you give me my rights before this group, I don't want it, right? A lot of people from our community got mad. Mike, you betrayed us. And I said to myself, you know, this happened about 100 years ago. And 100 years ago, this happened. This group was born out of it, this group. And we've been in fight for 120 years. And the people who rule still rule. The planter class of the South still rule. Old rich white men whose family's been rich 200-300 years still rule the South. Right. Nobody's progressed to the point we could have as equals because we allowed ourselves to take a little here, take a little there. It's time that we end that in this country. And it's really time that everyone have the equity and equal opportunity. Now, what you do with your opportunity is on you. If you get the right to vote and you don't exercise and your community suffers, that is a part of your problem and fault, and you're going to fix that. But it is my duty to make sure you have that right and share that right equally with me.
That reminds me of something that you said. We were at a Black college in South Carolina at the time, Bennett. And you quoted Eugene Debs. So what you just are saying, I mean, what you are really articulating is a humanitarian vision.
Absolutely.
It doesn't disregard the unique suffering and challenges.
Not at all.
That Black people face under the weight of a system that has never seen us as equals. Yes. And even in the 21st century, we are still fighting for that.
Absolutely.
But you always have a way of layering, both telling the truth about that reality, but also talking about the reality of the pain and suffering of others. It doesn't negate the fact that Black people suffer in deeper ways to say, oh, my brother over there or my sister over there is suffering too. So Eugene Debs, while there is a lower class, I am in
am
it.
In
Remember
it.
You said this.
Yeah, absolutely.
While there is a criminal element, I am of it.
Of it,
and
absolutely.
While there is a soul in prison, I am not free. Come on.
Ah, come on, man.
That's it.
That's a white man. That's a white man that ran for president. That while in federal prison in Atlanta, he was in the USP in Atlanta, the same prison we used to play
in.
Yeah, he was in Atlanta. He and Marcus Garvey were both in the United States Penitentiary in Atlanta. And I say that just because, you know, I don't want us to lose hope and allyship. No war is won without allies.
That's right.
And politics is war without blood. It is the ability to move and navigate society without necessarily bloodshed. That's the lowest form of politics, when you got to pick up a gun and go hit somebody over the head and take what they got or defend what you got. But before that, you have the ability to plot, plan, strategize, organize, and mobilize to fix things. And Debs did that. Debs attempted to. One of the highest honors I've ever had is not just winning the Grammy, not just winning some other awards, but was the Frederick Douglass Eugene Debs Socialist Democrat Award. Because the work that these two men in particular, one black, one white, you know, they benefited all Americans in a way that we don't acknowledge. They should be taught to kindergartners.
That's right.
You know, Lucy Parsons should be taught to kindergartners. And how would the world be different if we did? You know, I went to Frederick Douglass High School in Atlanta, an all-black neighborhood with all-black kids, but Frederick Douglass was the most photographed person of the 19th century. Essentially, he was a Barack Obama image-like. In terms of image, everybody had a picture of Frederick Douglass, right? Why isn't Frederick Douglass taught in the middle of Montana? Why isn't there a Frederick Douglass High School in the middle of Iowa where there's no black kids? Because we don't truly regard this man as an American hero. He's still sectioned off. And we do that. And it's nothing wrong with him being a black hero, but we have to start to recognize this man's an American hero. People get angry sometimes that look like me because I'll put up Eugene Debs on my accounts and praise him, or I'll put up John Brown. But I need my children to understand that all white people ain't enemies and all white people ain't evil. But you have to start to separate what's an ally, what's a friend, what's a co-conspirator. Because when go down, you got to know who's going to tell. And you got to know not to tell them.
But that's right. And who gonna hang all the way to the end.
Yeah, but I try to make sure that I am influenced by those who don't look like me as much as I am. But I'm first and foremost a black man, and I understand the unique circumstance and issues with this system I deal under. It is a worldwide system. No system is perfect. It is not perfect. The UK. It is not perfect in Australia. It is not perfect in Italy or Greece or any other country I've been in that we are in. So I just want us to recognize that not only are we having issues and problems here, it is a worldwide system. Racism is 500 years old because race has been created 500 years ago. We have the ability through people like another white woman, Jane Elliott, and her Blue Eye Brown Eye program. We have the ability
to chip. Which is a magnificent.
Magnificent.
Michael, I want people to really go and Google Jane Elliott as
Please
well.
Do. And she's still here.
Yeah, she is absolutely still here. I know you and her have a very strong relationship. I first encountered her in the early 90s. She came to my community college where I was a student. And I was so fascinated with this white woman telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about race. And she basically looked across the audience and she said, the people who are in this room are not the people who should be here. I need to talk to the people who are not in this room. Hello, somebody. So the Blue Eye Brown Eye test, if people don't know, just really quickly.
Go watch that.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. She wants to figure out a way to explain to her students, all white class, about why Dr. King was murdered and what he was standing for. And she separated her students into two categories.
Think you know how that would feel to be judged by the color of your skin?
Yeah.
Do you think you do? No, I don't think you'd know how that felt unless you had been through it, would you? It might be interesting to judge people today by the color of their eyes. Since I'm the teacher and I have blue eyes, I think maybe the blue-eyed people should be on top the first day.
And the brown eyes. I don't want to give it all away. I'm just going to stop right there.
But check it out. Her daughter, Mary, calls me often. We talk a lot. I talk to Jay. Go on YouTube, Google Jane Elliott. For white people who say, Mike, what can I do? Yes. And because there's a sincere what can I do, the first thing you can do, like Jane told me, I was like, I want you to teach me. She said, I learned everything I know from black people. You need to talk to more older black people. So first of all, befriend somebody who doesn't look like you. But before you go on that quest for friendship, go watch about an hour's worth of Jane Elliott speeches. Watch her talk. Teach. Go to her classroom, and she's going to teach you, and you're going to start to understand the triggers. Like a friend of mine said to me in front of her, you helped me realize and get rid of some of the racism I held. Now, mind you, I've known this guy at this point 5 to 7 years. He's one of my better friends. He's a white guy. But I had never seen him as racist or harboring any of that. But he had to have a long talk with himself and say, these are some things that I have to fix. And he did it without me as a black friend having to point it out and say, you're bad. He got a chance to deal with that and learn from someone who looked like him. So it's your job to be the ambassadors for your tribe once you learn, white folk. I love you guys. But goddamn, we can't teach you everything. We got to deal with some issues.
So, relationship. That's yep, go, what talking about.
Get you some relationships with some
get
people
you some
around
relationships.
You. Absolutely.
What? Why did Miss Elliott, has she ever, why did she do it? Because she caught a lot of flack from white parents. They wanted her
yeah,
to fight.
She was in Iowa. And yeah. and her father kept a good relationship with her, but her family did not. She suffered a lot. And she did it because the same reason that you told the truth about politicians and you get punished for it, because it's the right thing to do. She did it for the same reason Fannie Lou Hamer defended the poor, be they black or white, because it's the right thing to do. She did it for the same reason that King sat down with a devout racist and Lyndon Baines Johnson and got the civil rights bill signed, because it's the right thing to do. Did it for the same reason that Malcolm X, you know, attempted to take the United States to court, and he was assassinated by whom? We don't know. It's subject to opinion. And if his friend in Kenya Pinto was assassinated 2 weeks later, because it's the right thing to do. For the same reason Dick Gregory did it to the day he died. It's the right thing to do. And at some point, we're just going to have to decide to do the right thing. And everybody who does the right thing does not get assassinated. It does not become a martyr. It does not die. But it is a troubled field and troublesome life sometimes. But we signed up for it, and we have to do it. And you have to stand in solidarity with those that do. And if we do not, then we have no reason to complain, because by being silent while evil happens is to allow it to happen.
Well, I am a witness to that, Michael, from experience. I can tell yes. you. Do the right thing.
Do the right thing. You know, yep, it's going to kick in your ass sometimes, but do the right thing.
Hello Somebody is a production of Large Media Network. Our logo and web design was created by Grace & Co. Special thanks to other members of the Hello Somebody team: Tiffany Hale, Pepper Chambers, the Hot One, Julia Griffin, Angelo Greco, and Anna Mesa. Now, if you would like to support our production, please become a member on patreon.com/hellosomebody. And finally, come join us for more conversation on my social media channels at Nina Turner. Lord, let me start that again. Ah, I'm having a synapse lapse. Okay.